Hello, and welcome to the Strength to Be Human podcast with your host, author and playwright Mark Anthony Rossi. This show explores all forms of creativity for those searching for meaning and a place in the world. To err is human, but so is to love. Now, without further ado, here's your host.
Hi, folks. Thank you for coming back to Strength to Be Human. This is Mark Anthony Rossi, your host. We have a wonderful guest over here and something very new for the show, Renee D. Burleson. And she is an about-to-be novelist. Right now, she's working on her first novel. And I'm really excited to have her, to have someone that's actually near the end of this so we can hear more about the beginning of the process, some of the things that she's gone through, you know, in this modern era of writing. So thank you very much, Renee, for being on here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
Well, I'm excited because it's really a different approach for the show. We've done so much with people who've had a number of projects out or a number of plays or have done a bunch of songwriting for the stage. But we haven't had really a novelist before that is close to finishing and this is their first project. And for many of us who've done this for a long time, sometimes we literally forget what the beginning was all about, or sometimes we don't have enough regard for it because, you know, we can rely on our experience and our connections and maybe even some of the good habits we've formed. But we need to hear this again because it's very important. And I think it's a great thing for you, too, to be able to talk in public about what you're doing and be so excited about being so close to wrapping this up and getting it out there. Well, go ahead, Renee, and thank you for being here.
Thank you again. This is the first project I've been working on for like ages. It started as a series of three plays that I was kind of just winging it with in high school. I'm calling it Warlock's Chronicle, A Rise to Power. I'm hoping to make it a series of maybe six books. The main objective with this book for me was more or less to kind of send out that message that no matter what you're going through, there are ways to overcome, if not grow, learn. It's all about growth and being human, I guess you could say. If you've got a young man in like high medieval Renaissance age who's well into adulthood but doesn't know anything about adulthood, given that most of his life he's been neglected and mistreated by his family, and he's got to overcome those hurdles as well as some unnatural abilities he discovers along the way, and bonds of friendship and a lot of life lessons that we all face throughout our lifetime, death, leaving friends and family, some of us abuse, neglect, drug use, just more in a medieval to fantasy-like world type setting. And it's kind of ironic because this whole series I'm trying to build on touches on a lot of issues that are, I guess you could say, very important to me, such as I mentioned before, domestic violence, drug abuse and addiction, even some rough points like in getting over death, grieving and loss, and even some racial issues, as race and gender and the like still are very strong and present issues in our present day.
And a lot of these are in this book?
Yeah. In some way, shape, or form, they are all touched on.
Okay.
Yeah, they're probably the hardest parts for me to write in this book, because instead of addressing race in terms of color, I decided to do it more in a way of actual being a different race altogether. I also touch a bit on religious issues. I see myself as a Christian, non-denominational. But I've taken some time, and I'm still trying to take time to research other religions, as my main character for this series and for this first project is pagan. So I'm hoping I'll be able to grasp it pretty well as I'm making up my own deities and religious practices for these pieces. So it's been pretty intense.
Yeah, that's a lot because I always, and I'm not a fantasy novelist, but I've always admired the kind of research that has to go into these sort of things, because it's just not like you're writing a novel about some dude in Chicago. I mean, you have to build an entire society and beliefs and various powers and universes, and it's just so much stuff that you have to start from scratch from that I can see why sometimes it could take years to get one of these things done, because you really really have to do all that stuff. I'm like, oh boy.
Now this one's been like 3 to 4 years in progress, and I have the worst habits. I think a lot of people will probably even say they might have had it too. I'd write a chapter, I'd go over it, edit it, change it, go over it, edit it, change it. So I was editing the thing before I even completed it. You know, and right now I'm like, I'm 3 chapters away from finishing, but I'm going to be adding 2 more chapters in because I feel that this race I've created, it needs that little extra push so people can get a good feeling for them and kind of understand what they're about.
Well, I happen to agree with you because it doesn't matter what kind of genre the form of writing that you do. I found myself in the past, and I was able to break the habit, but when I started doing all of this quick editing, before I'm even done with the piece, I'm going back over there. What it does is it short circuits some of the creative flow that you've had in that initial writing, and you might even like ruin some of the inspiration you had because you're going back over there worrying about this word and this phrase, and you know, so I had to break that and learn that I need to go finish the project as close as possible, and then go back and do all that stuff. But if you keep doing it back and forth that way, it hurts you. It makes things slower, and it's not really the best efficient way to be creative.
Yeah, it does. As you said, it kind of sucks it out of you, and I was starting to feel that, and it was quite painful because this is something that, you know, as I said, I started in high school. It was just a series of plays, and it's nothing like those plays at all. It's changed quite a bit.
Well, it probably has to, because, you know, plays, they're no different than a poem on the stage. You have to do a lot of shortcuts. You got to compose and compress so much stuff into that to get it going, which means that you're going to miss out on a lot of stuff when you're trying to do what you're doing. There's no more shortcuts. You have to be the details, because that's what that kind of novel, and that's what that kind of story, and that's what's necessary to build that world. It's all about the details, and that takes time.
Yeah, it certainly does. And I'll be honest, I started a couple other projects on the side so I wouldn't burn out, because that was the other thing I was worried about, was how long this project has been ongoing. I'll admit I did open myself up to some criticism. I use a forum, and it's one I have mixed feelings about. I just recently got back into it after taking a year-long break away from it, so I'm still a little bit on shaky ground. But something else I've had to learn, if you open yourself up to criticism, you have to kind of pick and choose what you take. If it can help you and you can learn something from it, apply it. But if it's not at all constructive, and not everybody's going to like your work. You know, it's just a fact of life, or others are just not going to agree with your direction. And that's something that I'm even learning as a reader, that to take away is that just because I have a certain idea how the story is going to go doesn't mean that's how it's going to go. And if it does take a different direction, well, it's not my work. Whereas with my work, yeah, it's going to take the direction I'd like it to take, but doesn't mean I'm not going to be a little open to others' thoughts. But you don't want to open yourself up too much, because if you open yourself up too much, then you're not really the one writing the story anymore. Everybody else is.
And that's true. I don't know if it's a fine line. I don't really believe that it is. But what I do think that is, you have to put a limitation on somebody else's opinion of your work early on. you have to listen to some folks now and then, just because it's natural, and you never know what kind of interesting angle they might come that you didn't realize. But at the same point, there's a point where you have to you put a stop to it, because you're right. You'll either lose too much of your own voice in it, which is very bad, or worse, you might start doubting everything, and then you're going to be stopping it because you're like rehashing what somebody else said. And maybe when people say things, I don't really think they're sitting in a corner saying, I cannot wait to knock down Renee because this is so much fun. They might
right.
They might be just expressing what they think. And even if it's not useful, you know, you got to say thank you and move on, because more times than not, criticism from people isn't really meant to be mean. I don't really find too many critics that intentionally are trying to be mean. They might also be trying to grapple, you know, what you're doing, and that's superficially, I believe, how it should be looked at. Find out from a couple of voices who's being the most difficult on trying to understand what you're doing, because that could be an indication that maybe your story is not going where you should want it to go. Maybe it's a little harder to understand than you think. Or maybe what they're saying has some merit. So this way you're not putting a project out there that too many people think is too difficult to understand or too difficult to read. So those things could be useful, and they could be worthy. But, you know, if it's just that fifth character seems kind of weird, but everything else is great, you know, who knows what that's supposed to really mean?
Yeah. Well, so I think with me, it's all about direction. Because I'll admit, this project I'm currently working on, I'd say about the first half of it focuses on swordplay. Then the second half takes a shift, and we lean more toward the magical element, as my main character is a warlock. So it's one of those things where he didn't come into all this naturally or even at the appropriate age, because from what I understand, at least from what research I have done, most people at the age of 14, already at marrying age, have been taught their instruction, or at least have some form of direction in their life. Their life is pretty much already planned out for them. And this character, due to the rather dysfunction of his family hierarchy and just the whole, his family is just a complex mess. It's more or less a family of dysfunction. And it really shows, because a lot of things he's supposed to know and experience at his age in the world he's in, he is not. He has not. He's very, in a sense, naive and completely ignorant of things around him. And he's not at all entitled, aristocratic. He comes from a pretty well-off family, but not a family that was born into it. So it creates a bit of a kind of a paradox for the whole series, because he comes into power in the most unnatural way. And he's born into a world where basically that's already torn apart. You've got war already on the rise, and he's completely oblivious to it because he hasn't been taught anything. He literally has to go out into the world and see it for himself.
Wow. So it's sort of a fantasy world, but then also a character coming of age.
Yes.
Well, that should be a good segue for people to latch on, because sometimes the best way to deliver an audience to a strange new world is for them to have at least one character that's sort of familiar to them.
Well, that's kind of my hope, is that by the time his first novel is finished, that people will get an understanding for him. I don't know if he'll be completely lovable, if he'll be hateable. I'm actually hoping that he'll be more on the lovable end, but he's not perfect. This character is very flawed. And I'd say probably the greatest vice he has would be anger. You know, we all deal with a lot of difficult times in our life, and the way we respond to it often kind of defines us and helps mold us and shape us. And that may be very well the case for him, as he has to learn and see from the way he responds and the way he's observed the world responding to him and to things around him,
Well, I think that's great, and I like hearing that a lot because I think lots of the audience would be interested in a character like that. I think we can all like point to somebody in our lives or our family that might have been like that. We might even look at some elements of ourselves like that. So, I think that's a wonderful way to start the story and move forward. And I really think that because this show is about not only creativity and writing, but it's also about being strong enough as a human to understand that you don't have to be perfect. It's okay to be imperfect and still make good choices. You don't have to be. So that's a wonderful thing too. He's like a little like a moniker for the show in a way. So I kind of like that.
Well, that's something I've kind of learned too, is I've done a lot of reading. I mean, I'm not a reading expert or a guru by any means, and I tend to lean more towards the older classics. But the one thing I'll admit I don't like in characters that I've seen and have and haven't seen off and on is a character that can your characters that grow are the ones that suffer. I mean, having a main character that just, oh, is all heroic and never falls, never has problems, it doesn't make sense to me because even the best of humanity has problems, has weaknesses.
That's exactly right. And I think there was a point, I don't know if it's done as much anymore, but there's a point where they made people just a little bit too perfect. It's one of the issues I have with all this superhero stuff we're doing in the movies now. It's getting a little bit out of hand, and in my opinion, kind of a boring, because why can't we make these worlds where the superhero is actually trying to intermingle with the real world and do real world things? Why do they always have to have a counterpart evil villain, a super villain? And so then all it becomes is a big fight between two different powers. How
Right.
many times have we seen that? And how many times is that boring? You know what I mean? I
Right.
wouldn't mind seeing Superman sitting there and trying to talk about racism in a movie. But no, that would probably be boring for people. But quite frankly, he's not human. He's an alien. And anybody that doesn't like him because he's an alien is a bigot themselves. So why shouldn't he be able to talk a little bit about that? Because that's something that he is already having to face. But they don't really talk about those issues. They're just talking about, let's let them fight some weirdo from outer space or, giant rock hitting the earth or something that he has to show his powers. I mean, what
Right.
about showing up some part of him trying to be part of human? They don't explore these things. And in the end, to me, it then becomes boring because it's just another battle. Oh, boy. We haven't heard that
Now,
before.
I don't lie. There is a mean superpower villain, but this villain doesn't even come into it until book two or three. The first real element for the book one, is for him to see these worldly issues and to see basically how they're all going to tie into this later, because all these little world issues, religion, these religious wars, these wars on races, they're all going to tie together in the end. Right now, they're going to seem kind of separate and part of their own thing, but I'm basically trying to find a way to merge all these real life issues together into one great, big, tangible battle to where people can relate to it, especially in a fantasy world, because usually when you have, it's kind of a really sick, perhaps, way to do a metaphor, but to me, it's like making a metaphorical Hitler
Gotcha.
and bring it into the world. And another thing I'll admit that I've noticed that I find myself quite disappointed with, and this is going to sound terrible, is the fixation on male heroes, male supervillains. So I decided to do a little bit of a twist. My main character in this series is a male and is going to be a hero. But for the villain, I decided, no, I see too many male villains. I'm having male villains in the book that he's going to have to deal with in terms of personal life and the like. But his main enemy, his arch nemesis, is going to be a woman. So, and I also figured that would kind of make it kind of bring out that mold a little bit, because I have a thing for strong female types, I admit, as well as the strong male types. I feel like they are a perfect balance, if not a perfect opposition, because either they can work in harmony together, or they can work in and make a total mess of things by how opposite they are. Because just as I feel we can all be rational, I also feel we could be very emotional, in the way that the genders process and deal with emotions differently can make for quite a bit of a clash.
Well, I like it a lot. And I tell you, the main reason for me, and it doesn't matter if I'm a male or not, when you're a creative person and you're dedicated to doing that, and if you just want to look around fairly around the world, and it's not hard to do, then you start coming outside of your own agenda, and then you say, you know, if half the world is male and half the world is female, isn't it stupid that all we have is this male view and this male opinion and these male objects? Why can't we have some knowledge from the other side? Why should we not look at that and see what that affects us, and how we learn something more from the world, from the eyes of someone who's not our gender? So to me, it makes a lot of creative, logical sense. I think it's needed. I don't think you have to go for it and somehow be political, because in the end, it makes creative sense. I mean, to cut half the world out and just continue to write that way the rest of your life, you're missing so much. A very good example I found was a woman by the name of Octavia Butler. I'm not sure if you're familiar with her. She's considered one of the first, and considered possibly the greatest of the science fiction writers who was a woman.
Yes.
And she's done a number of books before she died, novels, and just about won every award out there. But she started exploring more of that, different races and different genders and all that. And you could see from her viewpoint how much she changed science fiction, and how you now go to places that you wouldn't have gone before because it was so male-dominated. And this is not to make males some kind of bad guy or to criticize
them. Oh, no.
But it is to say that, hey, if we didn't have her, I guarantee we wouldn't went to those different places.
And exactly.
I know a writer by the name of Linda Imbler. She's our first interview for the show, and I'm really familiar with her work. And every time I read it, I always say to myself, Mark, you never would have wrote this, because you don't have that kind of insight, because you're not a woman. So you could have spent 58,000 years writing and you wouldn't have gotten that. So that's why it's so important, because we have to admit to ourselves there's just so many things we're going to miss if we don't have women out there participating in this too.
Yeah, I totally agree with you on that. Well, see, that's just it. I'm kind of exploring both ends of the world, because if things go the way I want, and when they go the way I want with this series, it won't always be books from his point of view. At least one of them is going to be from, I guess you could say, the point of a love interest who's going to have to come and save his butt at some point. And also, the other big, I'm working on two works at the same time, I admit, and some people will say, well, that's probably not the best thing to do. I don't think it's a bad practice, so long as you don't spread yourself too thin. And this way you always keep yourself engaged in something. But my second work in progress I'm trying to finish, that's halfway to three-fourths the way there, is from a woman's point of view. And again, in a setting where it's usually very male dominant. Westerns, for example. I'm a big fan of Westerns, but the one thing you do not see a lot of is male heroes in Westerns. So that's my next project, is taking a woman and putting her in the shoes of someone she ordinarily would not even be able to be, which is that of a sheriff. But the way she comes into that isn't exactly your usual means either.
Oh, I think that's great, and I would definitely encourage that. But what I would say in terms of my own advice is because I've seen some Hollywood movies, and I've seen some cable stuff, and when they try to introduce women in the way that you are, they make it too unrealistic. I mean, if you know anything about the West, it was dusty, it was dirty, people
yes.
had problems maintaining the good health of their teeth.
Yes.
Women wasn't washing their hair every day, because sometimes they didn't have access to the water. So when you're making some female gunfighter and she looks just too much like a model with a gun in her hand, that's not very realistic. And
no.
I mean, because I saw a few times they had, I think, Drew Barrymore, and I think that Sharon girl from the Basic Instinct. She was in one too, and I'm like, please, huh? I mean, it's just models running around with guns. I can't even take that seriously. Then what am I going to learn from that? If you're just making it, you're just making it a guy with breasts and guns. It's just going to so you have to be, you have to really be a woman, and you have to really have the women insight, and you also have to have the women Western makeup of not having makeup, not having the hair right, and still being feminine, but also understanding that you're not going to be running for the Noxzema when the dust cloud comes. You're not going to be powdering your face in the middle of a gunfight. Hold on, I got a speckle over here, and it doesn't work that way. So I think that the Hollywood version kind of ruins it. And if everybody else wants to do this, they have to try to remember some of the grit and the grime, mm-hmm. and some of the issues. I read in a story one time, and this is when they really got into the grit of it, and God bless them. But I read into a story one time where a woman had escaped from her captors in the Wild West, and she got away, and she successfully learned to live off the land, and then got captured by an Indian tribe, but they didn't really keep her hostage or do anything bad. She was able to, you know, connect with them and everything. But some of the details that the writer was talking about was matters of feminine hygiene and how cleanliness could have infections, and you can have other issues out there that no one ever really thought about before. And of course, I'm not a woman, so I'm not thinking about, I'm not thinking about that. But when that was brought to my attention, I'm like, yeah, there you go. There's another issue where that's an additional complication, and how do you get that solved, and what do you do? And, I mean, she was telling the Indians about it, and they were telling her what some of the Indian women was doing, and she had to learn to adapt to that because, you know, they're women as well, and they had some better ideas, and because she wasn't longer in, you know, a regular modern town for the West.
She wasn't.
Yeah, so, I mean, like, wow. But that made it extremely interesting because now you had a real life woman and some real life Western stuff.
Exactly.
And that made it that much more interesting because you're not going to see that with a male character. You know what I mean?
No.
He's going to shoot a rabbit. He's going to fry it. He's going to take a pee behind the rocks. He's going to go to sleep next to the fire, and he's going to go out with his boys and shoot everybody else again in the next day. That's it. That's all you're going to see.
Yeah. Well, it's funny that you mentioned grit because that's kind of a central aspect of what I'm hoping to capture with my second work in progress, which I'm calling Seeking Justice, A Trial by Fire, which that's going to only be a trilogy if I work that out the way I want to. And her beginnings aren't very good. I mean, she's come home after 2 years of being away from home. Her mom took ill to tuberculosis for the first time 2 years ago, and her dad and mom sent her away to live with her grandma because she's too free-spirited. She comes home, and her mom's not any better. She's getting worse. And her dad's the sheriff, so it makes for a rather awkward position. She comes home. She spends her birthday with her father, and her father's shot down in cold blood right in front of her. So she's literally motivated to hurt the person who shot him because he was a close family friend, at least she thought. But there's a lot of things going on in her pursuit for justice that she has to basically find out. It's kind of a mystery in a sense. It's more or less not the who or the how, but more or less the why.
Gotcha.
So, but she also has to deal with her mother passing and taking on, I guess you could say, household responsibilities for herself. And being her age, you know, you'd think a lot of men would probably come pressing and knockings in that time. A woman was only good for housekeeping. They didn't have a lot of them weren't working. And if they were working, they could only work certain types of jobs, where she's trying to break that mold, and she basically takes up the badge. And because of her father's reputation and her being daddy's little girl, people are too afraid of her. So it's one of those things where she's got to overcome everybody else's perceived image of her and the times and break molds. It's all about breaking molds and her coming through a lot of nasty stuff. Again, my main message in a lot of my work is, no matter what you're dealing through or dealing with in your life, there are ways to push through it. Things may not always work out the way you want, which is another key message for this one too. But you still learn and grow from what you deal with. I don't know why I'm so fixated on those themes, but to me, they're very important because I feel like a lot of us, well, some of us never really grow up, or some of us struggle to deal with things all of our lives. And we sometimes are looking for that outlet or that inspiration just to get through each and every day, depending on what we're dealing with at home, whether it's trouble at work or managing finances, being an active advocate for your children. I mean, for everybody, it's different.
Well, I love the idea. I really think that that would do well out there. I think a lot of women would cling to something like that because there's not a lot of that out there at all. And so that's really important. And I think that even some men would actually like that just because it's a change of pace rather than just the usual, you know, shoot 'em up, talk tough, this and that. I mean, I'm a guy. I'm a military veteran. But even I get tired of it. Superman breaking everything, and you know the Marvel guys, you know, shooting at this and blah blah that. It gets to be boring. I mean, can you do something more now? Then I don't know why I'm interested in you. So I like to hear and see different things, and quite frankly, and it's just one of the truths of the world that when you get older, you realize and you admit to. But women, they mature faster than men. They grow up faster because I believe that the bodies of a woman and all the things that they have to go through sort of forces you to be a more mature individual than a guy. We are simpler and we take a longer time to grow up because we don't have to face all those same things as a woman does. So in many ways, women sometimes have more of an insight already early in their life to the world than men do. And it's reason why we need to have more of that input into creativity, because it will teach lessons that we might not see for a long time because it's just too dominated with one side.
Right. And I'll admit, I'm trying to also make sure that, you know, that men aren't all perceived as bad guys. I mean, I feel bad because the main bad guy in this book technically dies in the first chapter. But the reality of that doesn't hit until the end. So it's going to be quite a bittersweet read, I think.
I agree with you, and I say that a lot, because as much as I understand that, you know, men have the issues and we have things to work through and we have some limitations as well, I always remind women writers, especially when they come across extremely strident, I said, listen, there's no one that says that you can't write about women, support women, and do everything you want about women, but also remember that there's plenty of good guys out there. Not all guys are bad. And
exactly.
If you think that you need to be a woman by spending 300 pages of stepping on my privates, not only are you not being realistic, you're also going to be hurting your audience as well, too, because men don't mind the criticism. They just don't want to feel like they've been written out of the universe either.
Exactly.
Because of somebody might have had a few bad experiences, because that's not really fair. That's not really fair or accurate either.
It's funny that you bring that up, because that is something I kind of play with I'm trying to play with in my other big work in progress with Seeking Justice, because there are quite a few bad men in this book, but there's also, I have a central character that's kind of, I guess you could say the complete opposite, a guy who's lived, who's learned, who's even at least 6 to 8 years, the main character, Senior, Angela Senior, and he's loved, he's lost, I mean, he's a widower working on a homestead with two young children to raise, and he, I guess you could say, ends up being one of two main central focal points that kind of help adjust her moral compass a bit as she goes through trying to figure out the why. And I've had some good and bad experiences myself and with men in my life, and I guess you could say that's part of what I'm trying to reflect in this particular piece is the good and the bad, that, you know, get that message out there that, yeah, there's some bad men out there. Yeah, women have to stand up for themselves and break the mold, and that they can do what they want to do if they work toward it. But at the same time, that we're still females, and we still have emotions, and we still have our weaknesses too, and it doesn't take a man to fix them, but we can have good lasting relationships and friendships and even intimate relationships with a person of the opposite gender. That doesn't always have to be, you know, they're the bad guy and they're out to hurt us. It's just not that way.
And I totally agree. I get lots of people that have questions for me or ask advice, and sometimes from the creativity, you tip a little bit into the real world. And I've had a few conversations where, without trying to sound defensive, I always remind women, I said, listen, just because not every one of those guys out there are good or even good for you, you still have to exercise your own personal responsibility. And I often say, and as hurtful as it might sound, women, they are better attuned to the person they're dealing with early on. I mean, I haven't found a woman yet that didn't realize that the guy they were with was a dummy from day one, but they're hanging out with them to day 300 before they break up, and they're like, wow, what a bad guy, and he messed up my life. And I'm always saying, you kind of known this. You got to take some fault, too. You got to take some responsibility. Why didn't you cut it off early? Why didn't you make some different choices? Why do you have to go a year before you figure this out when you kind of figured it out the first week? So as much as there are guys out there that are simply not the right person for that individual, we have plenty of women out there that they make choices that are wrong. And sometimes they keep making the same choices that are wrong because they haven't learned from that. And they might also evaluate that too, because in the end, it could just be that they're not making the right choices because they don't really have a full understanding about what they want.
Right. Well, it's great that you mentioned that too, because those are also somewhat points, though perhaps not always from a romantic point of view, that I'm touching on in that work in progress, is that sometimes, you know, something will be there right in front of your face. And as much as you might love someone, whether it's a family member, a friend, you know, a lover, a husband, a boyfriend, you know, someone that's just very special and important to you, you may not always see their faults, especially if there's someone you look up to and have a great deal of respect for. You won't always see their flaws, and that is something I touch quite heavily on in this book, and how perceptions can change and how errors in judgment can be made. It's actually a really big focal point of that work in progress. It was quite a heart tugger for me. But then I also have a soft spot for my main character in there. So, yeah, it's one of those things where, yeah, I'll admit, life experience has been a big inspiration for me. If not my own, then someone I know or things I've seen or watched other people go through that I felt bad about, things, you know, that I, as I said, I feel strongly about, you know, issues that hit me close to home in some ways. And I also like exploring worlds that are different for me. As I said myself, I'm not a pagan, and my main character in my work in progress, the Warlock's Chronicle, the first segment of it, Rise to Power, he is a pagan. And I go on the other end of the spectrum with Angela in Seeking Justice. She's brought up in a Christian household. She herself is a Christian, but you'd probably call her more the Christian when it comes to morale, when it comes to her beliefs, but when it comes to her behavior at times, she is probably as bad as a sailor.
Gotcha.
She's got a good heart, but she's still human. She's got one heck of a temper.
Well, I really think it's an excellent approach, and what you're doing is important for your work, and it's also important for creativity, because if you look at it like this, and I don't want to simplify it, but in the basic terms, women tend to internalize things, and they can be far stronger in the characterization and some of the motivations in these books than men, who tend to think more outside of themselves because they don't want to write about those sort of things. So it's always about robots and space aliens and shooting this and blah, blah, that. And nothing that's wrong with that, but it leaves some of the life out of it. And then the women writers, they tend to bring that back into it. It makes for a much more interesting read if you're just getting, you know, tired of just the black and white action shoot 'em up type of books.
Yeah, and I like my action, don't get me wrong. I mean, it helps to move the plot along, but without those intimate discussions, those secrets coming out, the conflicts of just day-to-day life, of, you know, just having a bad relationship with someone, of not meeting someone's approval. These are things that, you know, regardless of your gender, that some people just really, really get upset about. I mean, a lot of us want to be accepted by somebody or loved by somebody, and, you know, boy or girl, doesn't matter, male or female, you know, we all experience rejection on some level. And, you know, to me, if you don't put those kind of things in a story, it's kind of lacking the heart. And if a story doesn't have heart, it's hard to really fall in love with the story.
No, and I agree. I think that's the reason why women need to go out there and do more of this, and why, and more they're going to be accepted when they do. In fact, this is probably a good time for you in the writing world, because they're taking female novelists and fantasy writers and even science fiction a lot more serious than they've done even 10 years ago. So you're right on the right cusp of it, as long as you don't wait another 5 years to finish these projects. I think you're right on the line of what I'm already starting to see, where they actively say sometimes. I've seen publishers literally say, hey, we love our men, but we'd love to see a couple of female writers do some of this stuff, and we'll take that seriously, which is a great door for you to maybe go through, because maybe they'll look at yours more than somebody else's and give you the chance that you need or that you're looking for, that you might not have gotten in the past when they would have said, oh, that's a girl. What can she tell me about the Old West? Blah, blah. Let me go to this guy. Well, they're not thinking like that anymore, which means that, you know, things are opening up, and that's a good thing for you and what you're trying to do.
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, that one's, I don't see being done for probably another year or two, but Warlock's Chronicle, I'm really sincerely pushing to have done within the next year. So, I mean, as far as finishing it, getting it all the way written down on paper, yeah, it's going to be done this year. But as far as getting it where I want it in terms of editing, because, yes, I'm going to go all the way through it and edit it. I want to take the time to make sure I've got it where it needs to go and make sure that I have the direction right and everything's making sense and that there's no little plot holes that just don't quite make sense. Or that if they don't, that they're the right ones.
and this is the first project for you, and you're already talking a lot of writer that has a lot of experience, and it's some of the lessons that we try to convey on the show, is that it's important to take some time and to look things over and not to be in the rush. And as much as I can't wait for you to get this done and get it out there, at the same time, I agree with you. You got to do that, because it's one of the big faults of writing today, of all different projects, from a poem to a fantasy novel, is that folks are get impatient, take shortcuts, or don't really review things carefully. And I'm telling you, folks, and I don't want to be the Debbie Downer over here, or Danny Downer, okay? But you might not only get one shot at one place. You might not get another chance if they're not impressed, and if you ruined it for yourself. I don't mean that in all of publishing and all in your life, but, you know, if you send over the ABC publishing and they're like, this person got some talent, but they haven't taken care of business, have a good day, you might not be able to go back with them again. They'll remember you, and that'll be that. They might not ever give you another chance, when it could have only took another week or two or month to just make sure everything was in order. Everything was given, because that's what happens there. You have to go out there and give it your best foot, and the only way you're going to be able to take that first big step is to make sure that, you know, it's as good as it possibly can be, because there are so many people out there that are they're going to compete against you for only so many slots, and if you want to be one of those that's going to get picked up, you got to be more careful.
Exactly. And I'll admit, you know, I've kind of learned that lesson a little bit on the hard side myself. I mean, I've entered into a couple contests, jumped in, you know, got all excited, didn't bother to look over my work and sent it in. you know, thankfully these are, you know, smaller publishing companies, but even then those are also harsh lessons. Because you have to sit there and go, okay, well, are they legit? Because I won't lie, I've submitted work to an editor before, paid the money. Probably not a lot. Probably the amount they charged probably should have indicated what I was going to get, you know, the lesson learned. But long story short, I paid the editor. The editor didn't do the work, didn't meet the deadline, and then wanted to be my agent. And as hard as it was, I refused more or less out of, well, kind of, I guess you could say, a kind of a taut respect for myself. It's like, well, if they couldn't meet the deadline, couldn't do what I paid them to do, how can I really feel that they actually believe in my work and act as my agent if they couldn't uphold their obligations as an editor?
Exactly. It's one of the things that we warn about on the show a lot. And I don't mean to put all these editor for hire, because that's really who they are. I don't mean to all put them into the toilet bowl. But
no, there's good ones out there.
But I to remind writers all the time, why don't you look at a friend or relative looking at something, even just on the proofreading stands? Why don't you have a beta reader out there for free, exchange some something, and check some things out? Try to go through some of the free avenues where people don't exactly have an agenda, and maybe you can sort of shape things in, and then maybe with your own new eyes in a month or later, you can look at it as well. But don't go right to somebody that wants $750, and then you find out they haven't done very much other than take your money. Or in some cases, you might find the ones that are really good, but you might not agree with some of their ideas. You might not even care for some of their corrections, but you still got to pay them the $750. So in many instances, I don't recommend them in general, because I really don't think lots of them can add anything to what you're trying to do, because there is nobody, including an agent that's really great on earth, that cannot take care of your work better than you, that's going to care for it more than you. And if you think that somebody else is going to care for it as much as you do, you're in the wrong business then, because that's naive. You have to be your own advocate beyond anybody else, including an agent. This is not going well with the person quickly. Hey, I need to go on and get somebody else then. Have a good day. I mean, how long does it take you to talk to the limited publishing houses that are out there, you know, and to get back to me? Either you're going to like this and you see the vision, or you're not. It doesn't take that hard for them to do that. It doesn't take 6 months or a year. And some people wait that long, and then they find out that all the thing was, it was on the desk someplace and the person did nothing.
Right.
So you have to make you have to make sure that you're on top of things all the time on every aspect of your book. It's part of the new way of writing and life that we have in publishing these days. If you don't, you're either going to be taken advantage of, someone's going to waste your time, you're going to get some bad advice, or in some cases, some people literally have given up for a while because they just couldn't take the pressing negativity of what's out there. But there's also a lot of exciting things out there, but you have to be your own advocate. You cannot put it out there, I'm just going to set it out there now, I'm going to work on my next project. You better you better make sure this thing's in the right hands before you go and do something else. Because all that, this is not like, you know, you're going to make dinner now because you got the laundry going. Yeah, that washing machine is going to take care of business. It doesn't mean that editor or that agent is. You got to stay on you got to stay on top of them, and if you don't, you're not going to get the results you want.
Exactly. Well, my husband constantly puts it to me this way. He's like, no one's going to tell your story but you. Nobody else can tell it. Nobody else can tell it. You're the only one that can put it on the page. You've got to do it.
That's just simply the bare truth of it all. So your husband is completely correct. And a lot of times writers don't want to hear stuff like this. Even from myself, who's been in around everything for almost four decades now, they don't want to hear this because they don't like the conclusion, which is that, oh, I'm not done writing. I have more work to do. That's right. You do.
Right.
You do. Mm-hmm. It's just the beginning, finishing the novel. It's not the end.
Oh, no, it's just the start. And I mean, to me, to be this close to finishing my first piece, it's not that, I don't even know how to explain how it emotionally makes me feel, because it's exciting, it's scary, it's so many things all at one time. I mean, it's really frightening, because it means I have to start the long process of editing, which I'm I've already taken my foot in, because as you said, try those free outlets. I mean, my husband's already willing to read it. My husband actually already calls himself my number one fan, because he's been kind of following the story, and I mean, he's the person I can bounce ideas with up until 2 o'clock in the morning. We'll just be talking ideas.
Well, that's,
you know, and it's good to have those outlets.
Yeah,
it really
a lot of
is.
People don't have Find, that, so that's a blessing.
No, they don't. And to me, I consider it a wonderful thing because there for a long time I didn't. Growing up, I've been writing since I was around 11 years old. It started as a series of questions. The questions turned into poems. Poems eventually graduated into short stories. Short stories have now graduated into novels and plays and the like. It's just been one long dumpster strip for me, it feels like, because it's just, it's like as I so has my writing. So,
well, I'm gonna leave you with this, okay? And just keep this in mind. I'm not trying to add any more work to your life or to your writing, but what I've learned from hearing from other folks is it's becoming a normal thing now to propose a multi-book series in terms of giving it to publishers, whether it's a 3-book or a 6-book or whatever. And that's fine because I understand from the writer's perspective that they might believe that that's a good way to have some sort of security in terms of being published or maybe even a minimum amount of financial security from something like that. And those are not invalid ways of looking at things. But learn to look around the corner, because when you're looking around the corner, you have to see it from the other end. And the other end is, wow, do I like this book so much that now I'm committed to 2 more? Or 5
right.
or 5 more, because when the publisher is looking like that, they have every right to ask those kind of questions. Now, I'm not saying that they're going to ask you about, you know, can I see the next 2 books or can I see the next 5, or, but they're going to ask about, do you have a sketch outline on what you want to do next, and, you know, mm-hmm. are you committed to this, and you know, and all those sort of things. So,
exactly.
those are plans and those are questions that they're going to be raised. And when you put that book out there to that person and give it in their hands, you need to really have those answers. It's not like, yeah, I'll get back to you in a couple weeks. You know,
no, I'll be honest, Ed, it would have answers. They're not fully outlined, but the whole, all the books as far as story and direction are outlined.
Yeah, exactly. they're going to want to know you have that. They might even want to see that just to be able to know that. Because remember, you're not asking them for a standalone book, which some people do, and that's okay, and there's nothing wrong with that either. But in truth, you're asking them for a commitment of 5 more books on top of this one, and then mm-hmm. and they have every right to say to you, well, you're asking for my commitment. Well, what the heck is your commitment? And part of that commitment right. is your outline and your plan, so this way they know that they're not just publishing this book, and then you go away someplace, and they hear you again because you're working on a romance novel or something. You know, so just be ready for that, because when they're ready and they're asking stuff like that, it means that they're serious, but they're also business people too. They're not gonna take a chance if they just think that this is a fluke from a nice writing girl. They want to know that you're just as serious. And if you are,
right.
if you are, that makes all the difference on how you can continue to work with them, or maybe even how it's accepted. Because sometimes I talk to writers about that and like, you know, I never thought about that, and I don't really have a plan. And I'm like, please, oh God, please, have some kind of outline when you get this. Because when they ask these questions, they're expecting answers. They're not. It's not like a rhetorical question, or you know, hey, honey, what do you think? They're serious about that. You need to make sure that you have a real plan too, because they have to make sure that, you know, it's worth their time and money as well.
Exactly. Exactly.
So that's my little piece of writing advice from you that I hear from people that do this sort of thing. It's a special gift to do these multi-book series, and it's also a special torment and trauma because of so much work that's gone into it. I have a girl right now I interviewed that she is finishing up her 6th book, and it's taken her 14 years.
I could see how that would happen.
Yeah, and she's not complaining, but that's how long it took. So when you're talking
yeah.
about having a commitment, it's not just the other people on the other side; it's also that person too. Imagine doing a series, and it's taken 14 years of your writing life.
Well, man, I'm pretty happy about it because it gives me plenty to write.
I hear you, but that's just the impact of it all, you know.
Yeah, it's heavy, you know, because I'll admit just taking these 4 to 5 years for the first one, it's been an emotional journey for me and a half. Because, yeah, it's not at all the way it started. I hardly recognize it from the way it started to where it's at now. I'm like, okay, this is really how I originally wrote it when I started. Wow, yeah, a lot different.
Well, I really like all the ideas that you're espousing here and you're putting in the books and both of these book series. You know, I see a lot of value in them and a lot of exciting and interesting paths that they can take. But the important thing is, and this is not going to be for everybody, because I also deal with writers who are literary and they have a different path to take. But
yeah,
in your particular instance, I can see and hear and experience in my own mind the marketability of it. And that's the key to any agent, to any publisher, because in the end, they can always say, Renee is a cool girl, and wow, she can write. And then the third thing is, I don't know how the heck I'm going to market this, so let's just send them a letter saying good luck and God bless. Where in your case, they could say, holy crap, this is really marketable to an audience that's going to be interested in this. And then they can go about, you know, maybe this warlock could do this or this person can do that. But at least that becomes a secondary thing versus them even wondering if it's going to sell or not. So when they can feel that already, it really helps you to get you on your way, because writing is like anything else. You don't have to be committed to this or to that. You can make changes as long as they make sense to the story and they don't compromise the things that you personally believe in. And make them happy and still go out there and sell something that people are going to love and hold dear. So I really think that your chances are very good in that, because you make sense. You're coming from some real things that people can relate to. Some of that you can draw upon. So this way you're not running out of ideas or even running out of steam. You know, because sometimes our ideas don't carry us enough through the day. Sometimes you got to have a little bit of that personal commitment in there, or that passion about something that you think's important, and even though it might be a work of fiction, you know that there's a message in there somewhere. It might not be a message book, but there might be a message in there now and then. Those are the things that tie things together and make people interested in your book, and it also makes it as a writer easier to go to the next day, because some days are harder than others as writers. So I'm excited for you, and it makes this to be such an interesting and fascinating and I think educational interview for people to understand some of the things that you're thinking about and what you're going through and what you're still going to have to be going through, you know, in the days and months ahead. But you have something that is definitely marketable, as long as you find the right people to work with you, and just make sure they're the right people. Don't be afraid to punch somebody in the head. I'm an Italian, so it's a normal expression for me, and sometimes a normal action. But don't be afraid to do that, because it's not about being picky or being you know, a diva. It's really about making sure that you are guarding your investment, because that's what it is. I don't like to talk business terms too much in writing, because I know it turns people off sometimes.
No, but it is. You're investing time, your dedication,
you're doing
everything.
Yeah, you're doing 3 years. You wasn't doing 3 years because it's just so much fun. It is an investment. It's a creative investment, and then later on, it just might be a marketing and a financial investment. To not look at that and just say it's just creative, that's also being naive. We have to also understand that in the world and the way the publishing has gone these days, those dimensions, they have to be looked at and taken seriously just as well if you're going to have a chance to go out there and do something important. So don't forget that, since that's the realm you're going into anyway, you have to keep your eye on that. So you might have to smack somebody in the head or, you know, punch somebody in the brain or whatever that's necessary to guard what you're trying to do, so this way, you know, they're not trying to make you into somebody you're not, or they're not trying to misunderstand your project, because not everybody that even expresses interest might be the place that you finally land. They might just be on another path as somebody else, because now you learn something from them about all the things you don't want versus the things that you do want, and you'll learn that as you go along as well too. Just keep an eye on them. And I always say, be a little skeptical until things make sense. If they don't make sense, you know, ask somebody first. Don't sign anything until you do.
Exactly.
Renee,
exactly.
It's been an incredible pleasure, and I know it's been a hell of a different experience for people to hear something like this, because oftentimes I'm ending the show with, go to Amazon and get this book, or do this or do that, because they've done this. It's far different in this kind of interview, because this is somebody that I'm going to say about that in the future when we have another interview, because I believe the next interview, once you're out there already, then we can start talking about some of the nitty-gritty of the book and some of the things that you're hoping and dreaming for with it and going for it. And I think people will like to see that companion part of the interview, the, you know, sort of like the beginning and then, you know, the next stage. So it makes it different, but I think that it makes you very brave to be able to talk some of these things for folks to listen to, especially some people who might be already in your boat, so to speak. They might be close to being done, or maybe in the middle of something, and they like to hear this kind of encouragement. And here's somebody out there that's doing all this, that's hitting the word processor, you know what I mean, and still having to live a life and a marriage and kids and all of that, and still out there doing it, because that's what makes artists more special to me than just the guy that punches a clock in the factory. Well, I'm not putting them down, but I always tell the guy in the factory, don't make fun of us, because you only got one job, okay? Renee got like three jobs, maybe four jobs, okay? So who you think is the more tired at the end of the day, and who you think we should maybe look up to a little bit more at the end of the day? The girl with the four jobs, or the guy that does, you know, the 10 hours and then he comes home and drinks three beers and goes to sleep? Well, let's be serious over here. This is work too, and it's serious work. It takes time that you could have done other things in your life with. Instead, you're doing this. So we should respect it, and we should honor it, and should we do whatever we can to support you. So I thank you. I can't wait to have you on again in the future. We'll stay in contact. I'll monitor what's going on. I always get a few things now and then in the background I might be able to pass on to you, so you can see on things that you might want to look at, or maybe people you might want to eventually talk to, kind of line it up. And go from there. But I'm excited, and I'm grateful for having you on here.
Well, thank you for having me.
You guys have a great week, and we'll talk again soon.
Thank you for listening. Please follow the show and visit our blog at strengthtobehuman.blogspot.com.